Uh-oh. You heard that, Joanne? Okay. So I'm going to talk about the phenomenology of Higgsless electroweak symmetry breaking, which is an extra dimensional scenario, as you'll see. And this is based on the work by my collaborators and myself. So I'll give a little bit, bit of a background on what this is, something about the structure of the model, and then I will try to concentrate on phenomenology associated with it, electroweak precision measurements, some collider signatures, and what I consider the biggest issue facing this set of models, unitarity in WW scattering. And then I hope if I have time, I'm going to go beyond what's in our paper and talk a little bit about some recent developments on how to solve some of these problems. And then we'll see whether the problems are solved or not. So, this looks familiar. What good is a Higgs? Okay. What does a Higgs do for you? Well, we've just heard. It generates the W and Z masses. And you just can't get rid of something. I'm telling you, it's everywhere. Okay. It generates the W and Z masses and gives the correct electroweak phenomenology, for example, rho equals 1. It generates fermion masses, but I'm not going to have time to talk about that. That's another whole hour. And as you've heard, it unitarizes WW scattering. Now, what I'm going to ask here is, can we get along without Higgs at all? We're not going to make it fat. We're just going to not have it at all. Now, and the idea is to try to do this without introducing any new particles from one point of view, which take its place. And what I mean here is the five-dimensional point of view. In 5D, there aren't any new particles, but we will have, as you'll see. And of course, we just don't want to do this. We want to get everything right. We want to get everything that we know in the standard model correct. And this, is, of course, is a tall order because the standard model has been tested so precisely. This is a non-trivial requirement that we put on our theory, and it hasn't been achieved yet, but you'll see that we've made some headway. So the laboratory we're going to use is, you'll see, so the standard model without the Higgs in one extra dimension in a warped space that Joanne and I talked about on Friday, the Randall-Sundrum model. And this is our laboratory for examining this. There's been a lot of work on this subject, and just flash you the references of lots of people who have been working very hard over the last 6 months. Let's start with a very simple idea. Let's imagine you have a five-dimensional field, a massless field in 5D. So its 5D derivative is this derivative squared is 0. If you decompose this into the ordinary 4D part and a 5D part, and this is equal to 0, then you, if you think about the usual Kaluza-Klein decomposition, this thing looks a lot like the ordinary four-dimensional equivalent with d5 squared, m squared, playing the role of d5 squared. Clearly, what this means is that there's some relationship between the derivative of phi, its fifth component derivative, and the mass. If you like, the curvature of the 5D wave function, then, is somehow related to the mass of the particle. Now, think about this a little bit more. If you think of about a simple model in flat space, so you just take an ordinary flat space and put a U1 gauge field in the bulk and apply orbifold boundary conditions, then what happens here is that the usual four components of A have a 5D wave function that looks like cosine of the extra dimension, and the fifth component looks like sine. So if you started to draw the first two Kaluza-Klein towers over here, first one you get is a flat zero mode, and the second one you get is a KK mode that looks like this. And these result from applying what are called the orbifold boundary conditions, that the derivative with respect to the extra coordinate of A mu is zero on both these boundaries, and the figure that I haven't shown is that A5 is set to zero on both boundaries. And if you solve this equation with these conditions, you see that you get this. But what this means is that the zero mode, the state with lowest energy, with lowest mass, is flat and is independent of the fifth coordinate and implies that it's massless. So the fact that the wave function for the zero mode is the lowest mode is not curved but flat is what results in the theory being massless, in the field being massless. Now it turns out that as long as you apply the same orbifold boundary conditions on these two boundaries, you're always going to get this. You're always going to end up with a massless mode, and that means that U1 gauge symmetry remains unbroken. But nobody tells you that you have to apply these boundary conditions. Now let's imagine we had a little toy model. This is a toy example. Let's imagine we took the same two boundary conditions but sort of interchanged them. Here we just demand that the fifth component, the derivative respect to x5, if you like, of a mu is 0 on this boundary, whereas the field itself vanishes on this boundary. Then the zero mode looks like this. It has no derivative here and it vanishes here, and the first excitation looks like this, et cetera, and you can keep drawing these things. But you can see that the zero mode, or the lowest mode here, is not flat. And therefore, this state, in fact, has a non-zero mass. And you can see that analytically by just doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation like this. The A field you can decompose in terms of sines and cosines. You take its derivative, you apply the boundary conditions, A goes to 0, and then you just find that the eigenstates are given by cosine and the mass pi r equals 0. And then you solve that, and you see that the lowest mode has a mass 1 over 2r, where r is the length of the interval on which you're describing your theory. And so here's an example where U1 is broken. There's no Higgs here. I've chosen the boundary conditions in such a way that this, the lightest mass particle has a mass. No Higgs. Now, at this point, there's lots of questions. Can you just choose any old boundary conditions? Now, this is a toy model, and it certainly worked in this toy model. And the answer is no. There are lots of restrictions that follow from just looking at the variation of the action. You recall that when you vary the action, you get, there are two parts of this, you get the equations of motion in the bulk, but then there are boundary terms that need to be satisfied. These boundary terms describe what kind of boundary conditions you can put on the field here. And it turns out, I haven't listed them here, there's a finite number of order 5 or 6 that you can actually apply in the sense into the case of gauge fields. But even with this small set of possible boundary conditions, there's still a lot of choices. And if you could somehow apply a choice like this, or something analogous to this to the standard model, you would be able to generate masses. Now, you don't want to generate any old masses. You want to generate the right masses. You want to generate the standard model with rho equal to 1, and you want the symmetry to be broken in the usual way. You want three bosons to get mass. You don't want the photon to get a mass, and you want the mass relationships to come out right, etc. So can you do this? And the answer is yes. But the simplest idea of trying to do this in a flat space, like up here, with SU2 cross U1 in the bulk, that doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is phenomenological. If you go through that exercise, you find out that for when you solve for the masses of the W bosons, the masses are given by an expression that looks like this. And so you find that the lightest W has a mass of MW, but its first Kaluza-Klein excitation has a mass 3MW. That's excluded. We would have seen that state a long time ago with the Tevatron. So that plus the fact that the electroweak precision measurements are inconsistent with this model imply it doesn't, you shouldn't follow this particular path.
We would have seen it if trouble quarks.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it does. And it does within the model. No. They're not qualitatively different. They're quantitatively different, but not qualitatively different. So you would have seen this state. There's no way.
Yeah, so you could argue that you have no way to put the custom you're
seeing. Yes, exactly right. So, what was done is two things. One, go to the Randall-Sundrum model. There are other reasons for doing that, solving the hierarchy, maybe getting unification, and also extending the gauge group to SU2 cross SU2, SU2L cross SU2R cross U1. The reason for doing this is that after you break everything in the end, there's a global SU2 symmetry that remains that protects rho equals 1. And we'll see later how that happens.
I understand the second step, I don't understand why you would require a minute or the first
step. You'll see that the mass relationships work in Randall-Sundrum.
In the second, without carrying the Randall-Sundrum, you cannot get...
No, it doesn't work. But it does work with Randall-Sundrum. Okay, so what do I have to remind you about Randall-Sundrum from Friday? The metric in Randall syndrome looks like this. There's a warp factor that sits out front of the ordinary four component distance. This k measures the curvature of the space. The space here is ADS5. And the distance between, we have two brains, and the distance between the two brains is pi times r sub c. This brain at y equals pi rc. I have these labels backwards. This one here should be pi rc, and this one should be zero. That's what happens when you do this at 2 o'clock in the morning. One of these is the Planck brain, and the other one is the TEV brain with these two labels flipped. KRC is not an arbitrary parameter, because if you want to explain the hierarchy in this model, KRC has to have some value of order 10, in particular 11. What happens here, as you'll see, is that the boundary conditions are chosen such that on the Planck brain, the SU2R course U1B minus L part of the theory breaks to U1Y. And on the TEV brain, the SU2L course SU2R part of the theory breaks to an SU2 diagonal. When you combine these two together, the entire left-right model breaks down to U1QED. Technical points, here, SU2 diagonal cross U1B minus L remains an unbroken gauge symmetry. And so there are possible extra terms one can add to the action, which I'll show you in a minute here. And over here, SU2L cross U1Y is unbroken on this brain, and so there are extra potential kinetic terms that you can add here. Okay, so what happens basically is that, as I said, SU2R cross U1B minus L breaks on the Planck brain. Three generators are broken, the right-handed W and one linear combination of the neutral fields with B minus L and SU2R. These get masses of order the Planck scale, so they're decoupled from the theory. And on the other brain, the other three generators are broken. W plus minus and Z get mass, and then the photon is left massless. In this model, instead of dealing with sines and cosines, one has to deal with Bessel functions. So it's a little more complicated. It just makes the code run longer. Much longer. Much, much longer. Okay. So the action for this theory contains two parts. There's a bulk action, which is just the sum of the usual gauge kinetic terms for all of the fields that you have in your model, SU2L, SU2R, U1B minus L, and SU3 color if you include QCD. And then on these two brains, there are potentially additional terms that are present because they respect certain gauge symmetries still exist, and a priori such terms are allowed by the gauge symmetries. This one, for example, is an SU2L term that can exist on the Y equals 0 brain. And then here's a hypercharge term, and then there are two other terms. Now, I don't want to go into this in gory detail, but these are, in fact, the boundary conditions that we're going to apply. Now, I can point out some simple ones here. These, you see, are linear combinations of the various fields that we have in the theory. The fields A sub LRA label the gauge fields in SU2L and R, and the fields labeled B is just the U1B minus L field. And here we see that, for example, on the Planck brain, this combination of fields, this field here, which corresponds to W right plus minus, and this linear combination, which is the broken linear combination here, its value, the wave function for those fields is set equal to zero on the Planck brain. And then analogously, there are all these other ones. These are not completely intuitive, but if you think about what you want to do with your theory for a while, you'll see that this is what makes sense. These deltas here are additional parameters that result from potential brain terms, those extra kinetic energy terms that I showed in the action before. For example, there was an SU2L term that was allowed on the Planck brain, and it had some coupling, which I denoted as GL twiddle squared. Parameter delta L that appears up here is just the scaled value of the ratio of the G5L, the ordinary coupling for SU2L in five dimensions, to this brain coupling. and it is a dimensional quantity, and to remove the dimensions, we scale by k, and for some reason, we also scale by 2. So these deltas that you'll see here and there are dimensionless parameters. Nomura pointed out that delta y, delta l, and delta s, the dominant pieces that could go in there, are calculable via the RGEs. I don't want to get into that. All it matters for this discussion is that these things are essentially determined quantities, whereas the other two brain terms are expected to be small, but their values are unknown. We set them to zero in the first part of the talk.
Calculable means you're going from zero at the strong scale?
Yep, and you can run them down and you can, yeah.
And you assume some boundary condition?
Well, you saw what the boundary condition is given. Yes. You should get zero on, there's a limit, and then everything comes from the RGEs. Now, at this point, you may ask, if there are no Higgs bosons in this theory, well, where are the Goldstones? Well, there's one tomorrow you're going to see, but the other ones we have to deal with here. Fortunately, the A field in five dimensions has an additional scalar piece in it when you decompose it in 4D. So any ordinary gauge field has the ordinary four vector and a scalar. So if you look at this in flat space and just do the usual decomposition, and you apply these orbifold boundary conditions, what you see is that some of these, what they do is they force some of these coefficients to zero. So for example, I apply these two, and I find that a mu n prime is equal to zero, a5 n is equal to zero, and in particular, the A5 zero, the zero mode, if you like, the lightest mode or the lowest mass mode that A5 would have, is absent. Now, what happens here is when you go to the unitary gauge, the A mu n eat the A5 n and become massive for n greater than 1. That's how the Kaluza-Klein states become massive. In the physical gauge, when n is greater than or equal to 1, these guys are eaten by these and the field becomes massive. However, the zero mode, A mu zero, doesn't have an A5 zero to eat, and so it remains massless. Now, what happens in this theory is that we don't have orbifold boundary conditions. The boundary conditions do reduce the number of degrees of freedom here, of course, but all they do is they relate components to each other. And A5 zero remains in the theory, and since it remains, it can be eaten. So in fact, this thing that we ordinarily wanted historically to remove from our theory, we now want to keep in the theory, and it acts like the Higgs, if you like. So this is the source of the Goldstone bosons. Okay. So there's lots of parameters, but in fact, most of them are fixed. There are three gauge couplings, so there's one overall coupling that, if you like, determines the strength. Then there are ratios of couplings which we can define, GR over GL, GB over GL. This I'm going to call kappa. So this is the ratio of the SU2R to SU2L coupling. The ratio of the U1B minus L and the GL coupling, that's fixed by the Z boson mass. If you analyze this theory on shell as we do, you input the W mass and the Z mass and you want them to be the experimental values, for example, then that fixes what the value of lambda is. Kappa itself is not an arbitrary parameter. If you only demand that this parameter lambda squared be positive, then kappa has to be bigger than something like 2/3 or 0.7. And if you demand that you have some kind of perturbation theory that you can do calculations in, then GR can't be too big. And something like GR over GL of order 4 is an upper bound. I mentioned already that delta L and delta Y are fixed by these beta functions and a G Fermi constraint. And then for the moment, these other two parameters we're going to take equal to zero for now. Now, as soon as you start analyzing this theory, all sorts of fun things happen. The first thing is there are multiple sine squared thetas in this model at tree level. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you know, in the standard model, we can define sine squared theta in various ways, and they're all the same. Mw over mz is cosine theta w, that's one definition. E over g, and here I'm being very specific what g I mean, this is the fermion-fermion first WKK excitation coupling. E over g is sine squared theta, and if I go and sit on the z and measure sine squared theta effective, and I'm at the tree level, all these sine squareds are the same. They're not the same here. It's trivial in the standard model, but it's not trivial here. Now, certainly when we want this theory to approach the standard model limit in some limiting way, we must choose the parameters such that the value of these three quantities is not so different. Because if they were significantly different at the tree level, then even when you do loop corrections, unless a miracle happens, unless fine-tuning occurs in some way, the theory is not going to work. So we must at least demand that these three sine squared thetas be close to each other at the tree level. That already puts a constraint on the theory. Now, what do I mean by these three sine squared thetas being different? Well, the on-shell value is the on-shell value. I mean, you just take the measured W and Z masses, and that's the value. It has nothing to do with this specific model. It's a definition. So here's the on-shell value plus or minus one sigma. Here are the other two sine squares. Here's the sine squared defined through E and G, if you like. And here's the sine squared theta defined through the Z couplings as a function of this free parameter kappa going from 0.7 up to, say, 4. And here you see that if kappa is small, these two differ significantly from the on-shell value. And we know in the standard model, they're all the on-shell value at the tree level. This is a tree level analysis here. So clearly, what we want to do is we want to start off with a theory where kappa is reasonably large, not gigantic because we're not allowing kappa to be too big, but certainly kappas of order, say, 3 or so would be preferred just from this consideration alone. If you're down here, unless there's some miracle occurs, you're never going to end up with the correct theory. Now, still analyzing things at the tree level, we can define what we call pseudo-oblique parameters. Conventional oblique parameters come from vacuum polarization graphs at one loop. But you could define, you could use the definitions of S, T, and U, if you like, in the literature to define an analogous set of quantities. People have done this, for example, for Z prime studies. You can't usually describe Z prime physics through the oblique parameters because it's not an oblique correction. The couplings are changing. But if you limit yourself to a few observables that are perhaps are the most important ones, since there are three oblique parameters, S, T, and U, and maybe there are three important observables, this is the one-to-one mapping. You're not doing anything deep. You're just mapping language. So here we're going to define these pseudo-oblique parameters defined by these three quantities. This is a definition here. So this defines delta S, delta T, and delta U. In the standard model, delta S, T, and U are zero.
So may I ask you a question? Because you said that the Cassler symmetry is distorted, but I don't really see that.
Oh, you will see. Well, what you'll see is delta T is almost zero.
Yeah, but if G prime goes to zero, all the sine squares will vanish. The Goldstone boson should become an SU2 triplet.
It's a Gauge boson triplet, isn't it? It's already a triplet. I mean, remember the Goldstone boson.
I'm sorry. So you should get in a parameter limit. Some parameter goes to zero. An accidental larger symmetry.
We didn't examine that explicitly. But you see that what you have in this model is that, naively, the Goldstone bosons are already a triplet plus a singlet of SU2.
The scale is not the same.
Of course not. No, of course it isn't. Okay. So, no, we haven't looked at setting some parameter zero to see if you can. No, we haven't done that. Okay. So we're using these as operational definitions of these quantities. And as I said, in the standard model at tree level, these things should be zero because you see that MW squared is MW standard model times the correction. Well, in the standard model limit, this correction is zero, definition of standard model. And the same thing here. This is the width of Z to nu bar, the invisible width of the Z. It's the standard model value times the correction. So of course, this is zero in the standard model. Now, what you would like to do is study this entire model at loop level. That is formidable. to say the least. Okay? Some work has been done. It's been very minimal. The one thing that I can tell you with some reasonable confidence is that the true S parameter from the gauge boson sector at one loop is small, because it's not just of order alpha. Well, you've hit the alpha here. It's suppressed by these set of parameters that you saw earlier in the theory, KRC times pi. KR is of order 11. Pi is 3. This is 1 over 35. So the natural value from the gauge sector in this theory for S is 0.04, something like that, times some number of order 1, which we haven't calculated. Now, that's not the whole issue. The other issue that no one has dealt with yet is that we have to subtract out the usual Higgs contributions to the oblique parameters. As I said, this requires a full one-loop analysis, and it hasn't been done. People are doing this. Okay. Well, you look at the standard, what you do. Well, you look at the, what I mean by the Higgs contribution is that if you look at the contribution to the various, just looking at the oblique vacuum polarization graphs, there is now no graph with a Higgs in it. Okay? Obviously, what happens is there is a, to some approximation, there is a, quote, standard model plus no Higgs, with no Higgs contribution, which are just, if you like, the lowest KK modes here. They're very analogous to the standard model. The masses are similar, the couplings are similar. So to order alpha, they're the same. But this model has the KK excitations in it, whereas the standard model has the Higgs in it. So what you want to do is you want to pull the Higgs graphs out and put the KK graphs in at one loop. That calculation has not been done. That's what I mean. Okay? Okay. So this is something that needs to be done. Okay. Okay. Now, again, since this is all being, this is a tree-level analysis and these are the pseudo-oblique things, when you see an STU plot or delta S, delta T, delta U plot, you should not compare two data, because the data includes these loop corrections, which we haven't included here. Your eye is supposed to just see how large these values of delta S, delta T, and delta U are, and know that in the standard model, you want them to be zero. So you want to go to a region of parameter space where these things are small. Now, this is what I mean. So here's delta S, delta T, delta U, negative. Here's delta S, delta U, and delta T. The fact that rho equals 1 is well enforced is pretty obvious, because delta T here is very close to zero. It's unmeasurably small. Whereas these two things are sufficient, are larger, and again, you might want to go to large values of kappa to get these things to be, in your mind, of order 0.1. But this is just a qualitative statement, because the full one-loop analysis hasn't been done. But it just points you in the direction of larger kappa being preferred. That's all.
Kappa is the ratio of GR.
GR over GL. Yeah.
So just one more question.
Yep.
That he was also appearing in the invisible width into neutrinos.
Yes.
Is the delta T value which you get out here sufficient to cure the discrepancy between?
Okay. No. Good question.
Could that be where S is negative?
No. Okay. In the way we have done the analysis, you can do this all sorts of ways. The way we have done this analysis is that we have started out with the on-shell definition being special, sine squared theta being 1 minus sine squared theta being mw squared or mz squared. And we've forced the Kaluza-Klein excitations for the w and z to have the right masses from the beginning. Okay? And then we start having calculated the coupling, as you'll see. Another approach is to demand that the couplings are correct. Okay? And then you calculate the W and Z masses. If you do that, these signs will flip. It's just a matter of what you're going to treat as input. It's not trivial like the, well, trivial like the standard model. It's much more complicated. So it's up to you to decide which way you want to study the theory. We've done it this way. The magnitudes you'll get out, of course, are similar. Okay. What about the KK? I've only talked about the lowest KK excitation here. What about the excited states? The W has sort of canonical Kaluza-Klein excitation levels. You'll see a little more about that in a minute. The quote Z KK excitations are a little more complicated. They come in two sets of pairs. First, there are every other level, there is a set of degenerate states, almost degenerate states. They're split by less than 1% or 1% or less. So first you have the Z down here, and then you have a pair of Kaluza-Klein excitations which are both neutral. Neither one is the photon or the Z. They're mixtures of the photon and the Z in a complicated way. These mixtures result from the complicated boundary conditions that we've imposed. The next excitation is only a single state, and then you have a pair of states, then a single state, then a pair of states. It's quite different than a conventional Kaluza-Klein model. I've never seen a model that looks like this, other than this one, of course. What that means is that if you plot the masses in TeV of these things, of course, the W and Z are just hugging the axis here. And then the first set of excited states is a W and two Zs, which are essentially degenerate to the width of the line. Then there is another neutral state, and then again a copy of this, and then a copy of this, and et cetera. It goes up like that. And what you're supposed to see from this is that as kappa gets bigger, remember we're preferring somehow larger values of kappa, you can imagine the theory is going to become more standard model-like, and this is one of the reasons the Kaluza-Klein states are getting heavier, and so you're getting decoupling. Their contributions are decoupling. Okay, here's my one collider. So, well, I'll show you two colliders slides. This is, if you try to produce the first pair of KK excitations at the LHC, this is what you get. Their couplings are significantly weaker than the standard model photon and Z by a factor of 10 or so. So if you calculate the cross-sections, they're about 100 times smaller. These things are not so heavy, but you'll notice that the integrated luminosity here is for the upgrade. Okay. Now, what are all these numbers doing in here? One of the things that we've assumed, and since I'm not going to be talking about fermions here, is that we've taken a very simple case where the standard model fermions, or almost all of the standard model fermions, sit very close to the Planck brain. If that's the case, and all of them are sitting close to the Planck brain, then you get the highest tower here. Well, that's 2,000 events, and even if this was 300 inverse femtobarns, that's still 200 events. You're going to see that. The dotted thing here is the background, so you're way above the background. But what you may want to do something better than that when you start constructing models of fermion masses, what happens is you have to take some of these fermions, in particular the right-handed top quark, and move it away from the boundary, from the Planck brain. When you do that, these two guys tend to end up having stronger couplings to the right-handed top. This reduces the branching fraction for these guys into lepton pairs, and since this is Drellian, it ends up pushing the cross-section down. No surprise. So, just to get a qualitative feeling for that, if somehow the top quark, right-handed top quark couplings was such that the width of this guy was 10 times bigger than the naive value, then you'd be sitting down here. But even if it's 10 times bigger, there's still a couple of hundred events at the upgrade. So you have a good chance of seeing this.
What am I seeing? Destructive interference with the background?
Here? Yeah. Yep. Well, it's destructive interference with the background and the fact that there are two states here. This is something we talked about on Friday. Now, of course, this model has gluon KK excitations in it, and those things have huge cross-sections. So even with 100 inverse femtobarns, well, here we go. These things have a mass of something like 2.5 TeV, and here you see in digets, this is 20,000 events. I think I got that right, 200,000 events in here. This is trivial, okay? Okay. The only other thing is that I think we showed this on Friday. Because all the fermions are sitting near the Planck brain, it's very hard to produce gravitons in this model. And in fact, their dominant coupling here is to gauge bosons, And so one place you might want to see gravitons is glue going to a graviton going to gamma-gamma. Graviton resonances are a canonical signal for the Randall-Sundrum model, and this is a variant thereof. But here's the dimple that you get for graviton resonance in this model for cap equals 3. And if you just look at the luminosity and you look at the number here, you'll see that this is invisible. The graviton resonances are not visible in this model, which makes it an atypical Randall-Sundrum model. Okay, now, this is what I consider the most important part of this model, or what I thought was the most interesting part of this model, unitarity. Now, the other role that Higgs has is to make WW scattering unitary, as we just heard. So how does this occur? Well, we know in the standard model, there's a four-point interaction between the Ws, and then there are S and T channel photon and Z exchanges. Each one of these amplitudes grows like S squared, but because of gauge invariance, when we sum them, it only grows like S. But we're not done yet. We have to get rid of this, and this is done by including S and T channel Higgs exchanges in the standard model, and that removes the S-like growth, and then we have a nicely behaved amplitude. Here we don't have a Higgs, so we don't have this. So what do we do? Okay, obviously these couplings here, here and here that go in, all of the tower states, which I'm labeling by Z sub n, and these couplings G sub n here, have to be significantly different than the standard model in some way, such that these set of graphs alone, when you sum up the KK towers, has to be unitary. Now this is a really tall order. Chalky and his collaborators found that there were some necessary conditions that the couplings had to satisfy, the couplings and the KK masses had to satisfy for this unitarity cancellation to occur. And this is, they were written as a form of sum rules. For example, this four-point coupling here has to equal the sum of the squares of these three-point couplings when you sum the entire KK tower. And then there's another condition. This removes the S-square-like growth, and this removes a more complicated thing, which involves the masses of these KK states, removes the S-like growth. Now, it turns out that these are necessary conditions for unitarity, but as we'll see in a minute, they're not sufficient. So let's take the model as we've calculated it here. Let's say for cap equals 3, and ask how well are those sum rules satisfied? So this is the residual in the sum rule, say the first sum rule. And this is the number of KK states that we've added to include in the sum rule. So we have one KK state, well, it's not so good, and we add another one, and the residuals keep going down, and you see that this is pretty good. Okay, we're satisfying the sum rule to better than 1 part in 10 to the 7. Now it turns out that to get this result and the unitarity results that follow, it requires you to do very high and very have calculations which are very precise, and this is not trivial. And to do this, this was checked on 3 different platforms using Maple, Mathematica, Fortran, okay, by 4 sets of people doing this in multiple different ways. There's no way you could trust the result from this unless many people do it. This is something that you actually have to look at cancellations to many significant figures of order 50.
Is this the Bessel functions or something else?
Part of the Bessel functions, yes. Okay, so...
So this mechanism that you, with Chalky summon, is not related to the Randall summon. You can also do it...
Nope, you can do it in flat space too, same conditions.
Then it's much easier to do this.
Oh yes. Oh, we have taken this model. The model you see here took 4 people, three to 4 months to run. Okay, we did the flat case in 4 hours. Yeah, it's much harder when it's Bessel functions. I hate those damn Bessel functions. Okay, so we saw that the sum rules and the first sum rule was being well satisfied, and it turns out the second one is also well satisfied. So you can go ahead and ask, do I really satisfy unitarity? And the real test is to calculate the zeroth order partial wave and take the test, okay? Is the real part of the amplitude less than 1/2, yes or no? Okay, we know the sum rules look good, but You have to go ahead and do this. So let's take the case cap equals 3. Well, here's what the amplitude does. Unitarity is violated right here. Somewhere near, you can read it yourself, 1.9 TeV. This is not much better than the standard model with no Higgs at all. Now, well, it's cap equals 3. Maybe I change kappa. Okay, well, here's the value of root S of where unitarity is violated. And you see that it's always violated someplace for the entire range of kappa that you can have. Remember, kappa is bounded from below, and so how it doesn't matter how large we want kappa to get. We prefer larger kappa, but you see that no matter where you go, before you get to 4 or 5 TeV, unitarity is in fact violated. Okay. Now you might say, well, that's the whole model, all this whole class of models is garbage, and you never get unitarity to work. That's not true. If you look at the flat space case and take cap equal to 1, it's perfectly unitary. So it's not an innate problem with the model. You can get unitarity. The problem with this model is that the electric weak part of the theory is totally garbage. But you do get unitarity. Okay. So this proves that you can do it, just that we haven't done it yet. Now, in my remaining 2 minutes, okay, let me just say, what can we do? Okay, well, it's been suggested, we thought about this too. Remember, there were some additional brain terms that we hadn't talked about that perhaps if we dial them, you can do something. And you say, well, why would dialing these brain terms do anything? In particular, this brain term that's associated with the U1B minus L on the TeV brain. What we want to do is we want to lower the KK masses down, because if they're too heavy, clearly they're decoupling and they're not influencing WW scattering sufficiently. So you want to lower the KK masses, and we want to do it with the couplings being correct. Correct meaning satisfying at least the sum rules. We want to make sure the electric weak parameters are at least as good as the simple case you saw. Small values of delta S, all of these sine squared theta is not so far apart. If we make these KK bosons, KK gauge bosons light, we want to avoid any collider bounds from the Tevatron, from LEP, blah, blah, blah. And we need to satisfy all of these simultaneously. It turns out that if you turn on this additional brain term, some of these things do in fact happen. Okay. One of the Z's couples like B minus L, and its tower in fact gets shifted significantly. Okay, so let me just give you a quick outline here. Okay, so the KK levels, in fact, remember the Z2 and Z3 levels are degenerate. I turn on this delta B and they split. This guy is pushed lower, that's what we want. Okay, we want lighter KK, so all the levels are pushed down a little bit, and this first KK excitation is pushed down a lot. That's something we wanted to have. The sine squared theta W's are pushed together. That's good. Here's, remember, cap equals 1 was very far away. Cap equals 3 wasn't so far away from the on-shell value, but here we can push them up and they're all very close. That's good. So we're doing okay. We go down the checklist. I won't show you delta S, delta T, and delta U, but they're better than before. Okay, we can satisfy by making these state light. You might worry that we're making it so light you're going to run into the Tevatron and LEP 2 bounds. Well, as long as delta B isn't too big, you're still okay. You can still be up here. Even for larger kappa, there are these bounds, but you know, as long as delta B is not too big, you're still okay. And then lo and behold, when you put this all together, the last plot, for any old delta B, you could ask, what do I get? I get this plot all over again. These values don't care what delta B is, it turns out. The KK masses that you are shifting are ones that don't couple to WW. Too bad. Okay? So after a lot of work, you find out, oh, this was only a month, guys. After a month of work and a lot of testing to believe this, you find out that, in fact, Unitarity is not affected by turning on these delta B brain terms, okay? And what I mean by not affected is that these things, the value of root S where violation occurs is only affected at the 10 to the minus 3 level. And this was, again, checked by multiple platforms, and it's critical to do this. So, as I said, the reason for this is that you're lowering the masses of the wrong Zs. So this by itself is not a solution. So we don't have a solution. Okay, so here we are. This, as I said, this model is new, and it has lots of problems, and it has lots of things that it has to, lots of tests, lots of hurdles that it has to leap over. The first hurdle is to get the tree-level standard model. Does it have a tree-level standard model limit? And the answer is yes. We have to look at the precision measurements at the loop level. That all hasn't been done yet. There's been some evidence that this will work reasonably well. We have to satisfy collider bounds. We can do that. Uh-huh. But what we really need is to find some way to have these nice properties that I've shown you be satisfied and yet have unitarity in WW scattering. Now, as I've also mentioned that there exist models where you do have WW scattering unitarity, the electroweak sector is screwed up. And so what you need is to have find some way of balancing these two conflicts that you have, precision measurements and collider limits and WW scattering. And the question is, can we do that? Well, clearly a lot more work needs to be done. And you saw there's not a lot of people working on this, but I think more people are doing it now. So, thanks.
Are there any last questions?